Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we talk about your pet's health. Pets are such a wonderful part of life. They cheer you up. They make you happy. They give wonderful and unconditional love most of the time. Life just wouldn't be the same without them. And we're lucky to have Dr. Sandy Sawchuk with us today from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Takes time each month to visit with us, give us advice on keeping our pets healthy and happy. And Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
It's nice to be here. And you know, one of the reasons why I love coming on this show so much is that I get to hear kind of what all the concerns are that people have and kind of got my finger on the pulse of pet mm-hmm. ownership. And last show, somebody called up and said, you know, hey, can you tell us about sago palm toxicity? And this is a plant that primarily grows down south, and I knew nothing about it. You know, I'm just mm-hmm. like, well, go to the ASPCA's website. They have, you know, all the poisonous plants and non-toxic plants listed.
Sure.
And go there. But so I went and did a little research, and I am just shocked. In fact, I was at one of the big box home improvement stores last weekend, and they sell these plants right there with nothing on it to say that it's toxic.
And these are really toxic.
Very toxic. They look like something that a pet wouldn't want to eat because they kind of have spiky leaves. They sometimes are sold as a miniature palm tree. They grow native down in the southern United States, so that's where most of the toxicity cases have been reported. But now that they're being imported up here as a decorative plant, we're bringing them into our homes, and dogs, cats, humans, and everybody. I mean, it's toxic to all of us. The seeds are the most toxic, but even just eating a little bit of the leaves are extremely toxic as well. And about 30% of pets die even with medical care if
wow.
you get them in right away. So it would be one of those plants where I'd say, don't bring it home, even though it may be pretty.
So it's sago?
Sago, S-A-G-O, palm, like a palm tree.
Okay,
yep.
S-A-G-O.
Yeah,
something
palm.
To really
so,
remember.
Yeah, you know, they end up, eventually, if they do survive the acute onset of bleeding and you know, gastrointestinal signs and so on, if they don't bleed out, they end up in liver failure a few days later. So, yeah, not a fun plant to have around, even though it's quite beautiful. Don't have it in your house.
Willem in Colfax, thanks for calling. Hello.
Hi. I had a question about our cat. She gets very congested. It usually starts, seems like, in the fall. I don't know if it starts with pollen or whatever, and that she's very congested and both, you know, gets mucusy. So, and antibiotics don't seem to do that much. And I've gotten this Inosil, which is a lysine,
mm-hmm.
in an oral paste form, and it just seems like when I open her mouth, you know, her throat is kind of it's mucusy, and I wonder if this paste, I don't want to make it harder on her. I wonder if it comes in some other form.
Yeah, well, if you look at the name of that particular drug, it's actually lysine spelt backwards. So
yeah.
They weren't very original. Enosil, lysine, okay, so,
right.
And it is available in other forms. I'm just curious why your veterinarian recommended you use it. Typically, we use that in cases where we are suspicious of a herpes infection. What that particular amino acid supplement does is helps stop some of that viral replication, slows it down a little bit. So people take it for like cold sores and herpes outbreaks, and you can use it in cats as well. But it sounds like, you know, most cats that have herpes are going to have ocular involvement. They're going to be squinting and having eye discharge. This sounds like something totally different, like it may be an allergic reaction to something. Most, you know, dogs and cats that get allergies, their skin is typically involved, but we sometimes do see upper respiratory changes, and I'm wondering if wouldn't be prudent to talk to your veterinarian about starting your cat on an antihistamine or something like that to just give it a try to see if that doesn't control some of this mucus production, because it really sounds like your cat is miserable when it's like this.
Yeah.
It clears up. You know, it's like worse on some days, and then she'll be fine for a day or two, and then it happens again. So, and she does have eye discharge. And
okay.
He was concerned with this because he thought it might be viral rather than...
Yeah, the herpes virus,
well,
yeah.
I mean, just her, you know, snottiness or whatever.
Yeah,
it might
yeah.
be a virus, like a cold rather than... something antibiotic would be.
Yeah. Now, usually, I mean, if we do see a cat that has had herpes, sometimes, and almost every cat gets exposed at some point in their life, and some become more clinical than others. And remember, once they get exposed to herpes, it never goes away. It sits back in the nerves and then gets, you know, with stress and so on, will, you know, raise its ugly head again. But sometimes we'll see enough nasal passage damage from the virus that now we've predisposed them to secondary bacterial infections. Kind of like us. If we have a cold, you get kind of that clear, watery nasal discharge and you're snuffly. But then if it, you know, starts to turn yellow or green, that's the time to say, hey, we got an infection here. We better treat with antibiotics. So, and, you know, I think you can, you know, continue with the lysine, but you can get it in a powder form. And that might be a little better. You can mix it with some canned food. And when she's having some of these episodes, you know, try to take her into nice humid spots, like running the shower in your bathroom and having her in there so that it's, you know, lots of humidity. And that sometimes helps loosen up some of the goobers in her nose. So a lot of nursing care is involved.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Willem. Amy in Appleton, your turn. Hi.
Hi. How are you today?
Great. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I have an elderly cat who has arthritis.
Mm-hmm.
And she's seen the vet about it, and he told me to try glucosamine chondroitin, which I've done, and she doesn't tolerate it very well.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, she won't go near her dish if it's in there.
Okay.
But she's 23.
Wow, that's a record. Yeah.
Well, I just had one put down that was 28.
Oh, my goodness. Well, obviously, you're doing something right.
She's lifelong friends.
Yeah.
And I asked him if there was anything I could do for her discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, you know, her habits haven't changed. She can still get up on the bed. She likes to fall asleep purring next to my face. And,
okay.
You know, she's normal, except doesn't tolerate my younger cat's playfulness.
Yeah,
well.
She's a little creaky, and it would be very odd to have a cat reach that particular age and not have some arthritis someplace in their body. And the problem we have is that, you know, normally we would be looking at, let's, you know, put a pet on an anti-inflammatory, you know, similar to us taking, you know, one of the over-the-counter products to make our joints feel a little bit better. But they can be very toxic for cats, and we have to be so careful with using them. And unfortunately, many cats that get to be over 20 also have other concurrent diseases, such as kidney disease. And then we can't use any of those non-steroidal anti-inflammatory safely because it can worsen kidney disease. So our hands are tied a little bit about what we can use for pain control. There's a couple things, though, I'd like you to talk to your veterinarian about. One would be using, if she's having a bad day, there's a medication called buprenorphine, and it's available in a sublingual drop form that cats seem to tolerate very well. You don't want them to swallow it, so you don't mix it with the food, but you just kind of lift their lip up and try to, you know, get a little bit like under their tongue area, and it gets absorbed very quickly. And it's a tiny, tiny amount. It's a little pricey, but it works very well. In fact, we use that a lot for post-operative pain control in cats. So, but many cats that have long-term chronic problems, this would be something to consider using. If your cat doesn't have any other health issues, there is a diet that Hill's makes that is called JD. It's a joint diet. It initially came out for dogs, and they now have a cat version. And it has high levels of antioxidants in it, fatty acids, glucosamine, and so you're kind of getting everything that the cat needs in the diet. But if your cat needs to be on a specialized diet, what you could do is even consider adding in a fatty acid supplement. And usually these are fish oils, and many cats like the taste of them. And so that would be, again, something else to talk to your veterinarian about, is adding in a fatty acid supplement, which helps modify the inflammatory response going on in your kitty's joints. And that would be a nice, safe thing to consider, too.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Andy in Kenosha, it's your turn. Hi, Andy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have two and a half year old female cats. Both are spayed, and one cat just is very territorial about the other cat being in the litter boxes. I have two litter boxes. It's a three-floor house of about 1,500 square feet, so it's a condo. And when one cat's trying to use the bathroom, the other cat will just chase. Right out of it. And I can't personally imagine something that would be
worse than that.
It's, you know, I actually talked to an owner that, believe it or not, had seven cats. One covered litter box that she cleaned three or four times a day, but she would say the cats would go in and there was one bully that would lay on the top of the litter box and then swat at anybody that was in there, whether they were trying to, you know, if they were trying to get out or trying to get in. And so she was, you know, that was a very easy fix for her elimination behavior problems, adding in more litter boxes and get rid of the cover. So what I would be recommending to you for two cats in a household, we're always looking at litter box number is critical. You've got two. I'm going to recommend at least three, if not more.
Wow.
Make sure that they, we usually have a litter box for every cat plus one. That's kind of some veterinarian standard recommendations. If their boxes are covered, that can make the kitty that's the victim be a sitting duck. And so always be looking at open boxes, preferably in a location where she's got good visibility of the other cat approaching her so she can finish up her business quick and get away. And so you always want to have what's called good escape potential, meaning you don't put a litter box in a closet or at a dead-end hallway or in a furnace room. You want to have them so that she can see the other cat coming. And that may be one of the things that works. But there's a really cool new device that's out that you may want to just go online and hunt it up. It's called the Meow Space, like meow like a cat, Meow Space. And what it is a plexiglass box that has a magnetized cat door put in on one side. Now, you've still got the issue of it being enclosed, so you have to be very careful with controlling odors and things so that the cat will continue to use it. But at least she can be in there, and the only one cat would be able to get in because they either wear a key or there's a higher price version that runs off of a microchip. So you program their microchip number in, and as the cat approaches, the door opens up and then locks behind them, and only that cat can be in or out. And it's great for cats that need to be fed separately, or, you know, if you've got a dog that's trying to raid the litter box, that may be another reason. That's one of the things that they promote it for. I've had an owner actually just buy one of these magnetized cat doors. You can get them online. I found them. I just did a search and I found them on Amazon, and they're pretty much everywhere, available everywhere. And just take a big clear storage bin and make your own, probably for a little less money. Don't tell the Meow Space people that. But yeah, but that might be another way of giving her kind of her own private space where she can't be tormented by the other cat.
Sounds good.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks, Andy, for calling.
Yeah, and you know, one other thing I'd recommend is put a bell on the bully, okay? So that when the victim is contemplating going to the bathroom, if she hears that little bell going, she goes, maybe I'll just hold it a little bit longer until they get past. So that would be another thing I'd recommend.
All right. Thanks, Andy. Kathleen and Delavan, hi.
Hey, good morning. I have a 12-year-old normal weight Sheltie who runs and he does stairs with his ball every day, runs or does the stairs. Mm-hmm. He's had a borderline creatinine for several years, and his teeth have been cleaned, his gums are okay. So I decided to do just a routine creatinine check and decided to do the full panel because it wasn't that much more, and they said that he has a significant hyperlipidemia problem. The serum was very pink and thick and had to be spun three times.
Okay.
So they said to give him low-fat dog food. And he was getting a premium dog food, you know, with like 15 or 16 fat. Mm-hmm. But he's extremely healthy, normal weight. Is this like a normal or genetic thing?
Well, first of all, was the sample taken after a good 12-hour fast?
No.
Okay. That would be the first thing I would do is just recheck, because if he had just eaten, it's normal to have fat in your blood when you take a sample right after eating. And so if he's been on a high-fat diet, I would be expecting to see some lipidemia in the blood, so fat in the blood. So that would be the first thing. Recheck it after fast. Then, if it's still present after fasting, then I would look at, is your dog hypothyroid? Because some dogs will have that high fat level when they have a problem with their thyroid. So,
exactly.
Yeah,
they checked that.
Yeah, okay,
he
good.
Was normal.
Good, good.
It was like his T4 was like 4.1.
Okay, so up in the upper end of the normal range. So we don't have to, you know, because we're not worried about that. But then if it's still present like that, yeah, I would be playing with the food and be looking at using a lower fat brand of food. There are some of the, you know, the low-cal foods that are out there that are like recommended as diet foods, but there's one that's like WD that Hill's makes. I don't know if that's the one that your veterinarian recommended, you really want to be a label reader and go with a low-fat variety and then monitor it afterwards, because this fat can, although dogs don't get hardening of the arteries like we do, it can still cause them sometimes neurologic problems, and it's something you want to try to get under control.
Okay. How normal is that, though, for a dog? I mean, or how abnormal is it for them to have?
It is absolutely normal if they ate within a couple of hours of drawing the blood sample.
Well, it was like 6 hours, maybe.
Okay. But I'd still do at least a 12-hour fast. Just like when you go in for your cholesterol levels and so on, they always say you have to fast. And that's the way you get accurate results. So do that again, and then we'll call me back next month, and we'll see, you know, if we have any other ideas, okay?
All right. Thanks, Kathleen, for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest here, as we take a look at your pet's health. We have an email from Lee in Kakana, who said, I recently took my 3-year-old male cats in for their annual checkup. My orange cat, Max, is slightly overweight. My veterinarian told me that we need to keep an eye on his weight because orange male cats seem to be predisposed to getting diabetes in middle age. Dr. Sandy, have you ever heard of this phenomenon, or is it purely anecdotal?
I would think that I don't think there's a color associated. Obesity in general is one of the risk factors for developing diabetes in cats. And what, you know, because many orange cats are males, it's just the color inheritance. It's on the X chromosome. And so that's why female cats can have multiple colors, can be black and orange, and then the lack of color white and become a calico cat. But male cats, you see black, and we can see orange, and then you can see with the lack of color white. So we just happen to see more orange male cats. That's just the way it happens to go. So I don't think that it's probably anything, but I think paying attention to the fact that your cat is overweight and really working on getting that weight down. Portion control, monitored, you know, feeding and so on, really important for longevity. And we can have pets live about 15% longer by keeping them on the lean side.
Facebook question from Ravana. Now that the weather's gotten colder, my 12-year-old lab mix comes in from outside and coughs on and off for about a half hour. His larynx has lost its elasticity, resulting in a hoarse bark and occasional throat clearing, which makes him sound like a lifelong smoker. But this cough is a different sound. Can dogs get cold-induced asthma?
Not that I know of, but what she's describing is her dog has what's called laryngeal paralysis. The vocal cords are just kind of hanging in the airway, and so they don't move aside, which causes the hoarse bark. And because they don't have that protective mechanism to close off their airway, they're more prone to aspiration, meaning that if they can inhale things, they can trigger a cough, and they're more prone to getting what's called aspiration pneumonia. So I'm just wondering if it's just the fact that, you know, maybe when he's outside and he's sniffing or anything, if he's got more discharge and it's going down there and he's starting to inhale it and that's what's causing the cough. Most animals that have asthma are going to be coughing and wheezing, but it's not going to be an upper respiratory type thing affecting the larynx. It's down in the lungs itself. We see cats are kind of the model for asthma in people. We see research that's done on cats, very, very, you know, good stuff coming out there that helps people as well.
Facebook question from Catherine. Our puppy will be spayed in December at 5.5 months. We're trying to decide if we should remove the front dew claws at the same time. She will probably not be hunting, but will do a lot of hiking and swimming, boating during her life.
Yeah. Well, it really depends on how that dew claw is conformed. I'm kind of holding my hand up here to Larry. And, you know, we see kind of two kinds of dew claws. One that's called the articulated dew claw, meaning that it's got full bone development and it's a nice tight thumb, just like looking at our thumb where you've got all the bones attached and it's sitting up nice and close to the dog's leg. Then we have these things that I call dangling dew claws, which are, they only have the bone that has the nail producing tissue. And so if you looked at your thumb and just from the tip of your thumb to the first knuckle, that was all that was bone and everything else was just fleshy. You can imagine that your thumb would be like flopping around like that. If they're dangly, by all means, get rid of them because those nails tend to grow around and get caught on things. But if they're up nice and tight, I'd say save the dog the trouble because it is, you have to disarticulate and it's a major surgery to do that and lots of sutures and so on. So I'd say don't bother.
And an email from Faye. My golden doodle was recently diagnosed with Addison's disease. Yikes. I have to take her to my vet monthly for a $115 shot. Wondering about the regular immunization, like for rabies, Bordetella, so forth, since her immune system is compromised, what other meds can she receive?
Well, this just goes to show you that when you have a mixed breed dog, like a golden doodle, this dog has got a lot of poodle in it, and poodles are one of the breeds that are definitely overrepresented with Addison's disease. And what Addison's disease is a decreased function of the adrenal glands, and the adrenal glands have numerous functions, but one of them is to control your electrolytes, your sodium and your potassium balance. And when we get that out of whack, that really makes these dogs sick. And they also produce cortisol, which helps when you're stressed to be able to deal with stress. And so a dog that becomes Addisonian is usually vomiting and really depressed and has a slow heart rate. And it is a treatable disease and they can be managed very easily, but it is not an inexpensive disease. That's the problem. But I would be looking at working with your veterinarian to see, you know, if you can either lower the dose of the medication. The standard starting dose for many dogs that are getting the injectable form of the drug to control Addison's is sometimes a little high. And I've had many of my patients be able to go down to about half the recommended dose and even go a little bit longer between intervals. But it does take monitoring those electrolytes and making sure that everything's staying normal during this time. So it's worth the effort for the money that you'll save because it is an expensive drug.
Amanda in Madison, thanks for calling. Hi.
Larry. Hi, Dr. Sandy. I have a 6-year-old female Lakeland Terrier who for about 2 weeks has been hacking and coughing, and she's been licking the floor and then occasionally throwing up, and her tail's between her legs when she does that, and she doesn't feel very good. Also, she has like a firm abdomen, and it seems when I grab her around the abdomen, like I don't grab, like when mm-hmm. I put my hands around her, mm-hmm. she winces a little bit. And we changed her food from Origin to Sojo's, and that's all mm-hmm. we've done so far. And I was wondering what you thought.
I have to recommend that you get her in for a good physical exam to find out what's going on. It's possible that it may be diet related, but you know, it's interesting. I just reviewed a research article that was looking at dogs that lick inanimate objects, floors and so on. Mm-hmm. And I used to think that for many dogs that just, you know, do this kind of crazy, let's just lick and lick and lick and, you know, not themselves, but, you know, other surfaces and things, that it's just kind of a bad habit. Well, when they started looking into these dogs, they actually found that a high percentage of them, almost all of them, had some underlying gastrointestinal problem going on. Okay. And so my kind of comment after on this commentary on this article was that the next time an owner comes in and complains that their dog is doing this licking and stuff, I'm going to be recommending that you put their pet through the whole gastrointestinal extravaganza, getting some blood work done, probably some x-rays or an abdominal ultrasound to try to have a better idea of what's going on in there so we can fix it. The fact that it's been going on this long and your dog's vomiting and is obviously uncomfortable, I think it's worth, as soon as you hang up, picking up that phone and calling your veterinarian and say, hey, I've got a dog with a tummy problem and I need to get him in.
Yeah, mm-hmm. She has an appointment, but I wanted to check with you, if,
yep.
you know, before I went in.
Yeah.
Yep. But, yep. Okay, thank you so much.
All right.
Good luck, Amanda. Thanks for calling. And Dan and Phelps. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning. Two questions. On vaccinations, didn't there used to be vaccinations that lasted for 3 years, or are they all down to 1 year deal now? And
Yeah, good question. I'll get to that. Okay.
Point two, I have a puppy. Well, she's now 16 months old. She is very high, very expensive, very high strung bird dog, and very fussy eater. And easily distracted. Anything's mm-hmm. going on, she won't eat.
Okay.
But if I take 2 tablespoons of bacon fat and pour it on her food, nothing will distract her from that food. She will scarf that up in the face of World War III.
Ah, well, you
How
know.
How much damage are we doing?
Yeah, the bacon fat, boy, you know, it's you run the risk of, you know, irritating your gut. Pancreatitis could potentially be a problem. You know, I think that if I were to do anything, if you wanted to, you know, top her food off with something, maybe try like cooking up some ground beef and getting the fat off of it, or cooked chicken, and just a small amount if you need to do that. And, you know, but I would really try to lay off the real, you know, the fat, because even though it's, you know, you think it's a good use for something, it's just going to get thrown out. It could be a problem for her. Your question regarding vaccinations, I'm going to tell you, go to the American Animal Hospital Association's website. Anybody can get on there. They have the vaccine guidelines for dogs. For cat owners, you have to go to the American Association of Feline Practitioners, and they have guidelines there as well. And the guidelines for dogs are to vaccinate with a series of vaccines as a puppy. Do it again, everything rabies, distemper, parvo again, a year later, about the age that your dog is right now. So we usually finish up their vaccinations when they're 4 or 5 months of age, and then a year from that point, we get them back in. And then after that, those core vaccines, the viral vaccines, the recommendation is to go every 3 years. But this would be something to discuss with your veterinarian. If you live in an area that has a lot of parvovirus or a lot of distemper in certain parts of the country, they may have a different view as to what would be important. But the vaccines do provide much longer immunity than what we gave them in the past. And we know that they, in fact, some dogs probably even have lifetime immunity to some of these things. The things that still need to be done on an annual basis are basically the bacterial vaccines that are given. Leptospirosis, Lyme vaccine, kennel cough, Bordetella vaccine. Those are all ones that still need to be done on an annual basis. And if your dog is a field dog, I assume that your dog is probably being vaccinated for lepto and Lyme and needs those every single year. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Thank you very much.
You're
Thanks
welcome.
A lot for calling, Dan. Bob in Wauwatosa, hello to you.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm glad that the doctor is on today, because our 12-year-old English Cocker was diagnosed recently as having hepatitis. The emergency clinic in our area did a liver biopsy, and the tissue was sent to the Marshfield Clinic and was cultured, and they decided on a particular antibiotic. So he's currently on the antibiotic plus another pill that's called a liver protectant.
Yeah, Denamarin is one of the brand names, yes. Uh-huh.
And our problem is getting this little guy to eat.
Well, I'm wondering if he's not eating because he's sick and he just doesn't feel good. It's possible that the antibiotic may be upsetting his tummy as well and making him not want to eat. But
the vets.
Pardon me?
That's the consensus of the vets, that the antibiotic is upsetting his stomach.
And so sometimes we have to change antibiotics if we find that one just does not agree with a patient. So that would be something to talk to your veterinarian about, to have that taken care of. But, you know, sometimes we need to, you know, up the ante in these dogs that are you know, feeling pretty punky. You know, just like the last caller, I'm not recommending that you put bacon fat on your dog's food, but sometimes adding a little bit extra and not be so strict with this is what you're going to get and the only thing you're going to get. If, you know, if your dog has liver disease, there are liver diets out there that, not made from liver, but are liver, you know, dogs that have liver disease. It helps support liver function. And you may want to talk to your veterinarian about getting something like that, maybe in a canned formula that might be a little more palatable than maybe dry food. And anything you can do, warming the food up, sometimes hand feeding, those would be all things that we'd want to consider. And making sure that you're not putting medication in the food, because although it's probably more common in cats, we do see sometimes that superstitious behavior of, if I go to my food bowl, there's going to be something nasty hidden in here. So, you know, trying not to mix food and medication at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Good luck.
Thanks a lot, Bob, for calling. And Cooper in Cedarburg, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Hello, Larry and Dr. Sawcheck. Thanks for taking my phone call.
Sure.
I have a golden doodle. It's about 3 years old, 3.5 years old, and just this summer I developed some bad skin irritations or allergies. He is scratching underneath quite a bit and bloody elbows, that type of thing. And
oh, my goodness.
It licked his arm completely clean at one point in time. Finally, you know, we're covering with socks. He's currently on Benadryl right now to stop the itching. I'm kind of concerned about using that long term, but we even gave him a vinegar bath. It was something we saw on the internet. It was kind of a 50-50 deal, 1-to-1 ratio, and it actually helped a little bit, but didn't know if you had any thoughts on this or if
yeah.
Help him out.
Well, isn't this interesting? We've had two golden doodle calls, one that had the poodle ailment of Addison's disease, and now we've got the golden side, okay, allergies. Golden retrievers are the poster child for, you know, allergy workup and so on, and you see it on all the pamphlets that the companies make, and that's the why, because they all have, a lot of them tend to have allergies. A few things that I would be recommending, making sure that your dog does not have any secondary infections, which means a visit to your veterinarian so they can look at some of the samples from the skin. They may do some skin scrapings, they may do impression smears, and there's a very good chance that your dog probably has a secondary bacterial and yeast infection. The skin is a really good barrier, and when you start breaking that barrier down by having that inflammation from allergies, it allows these bugs to start overgrowing, and then that adds to the itch. Make sure that you've got your dog on flea and tick preventative. Even one flea bite, if you've got a dog that's hypersensitive to fleas, can keep them itching much longer. So religiously, monthly, give that flea control. Wash your dog's bedding on a regular basis. I recommend at least weekly washing it, because we see a lot of the pollens and molds and stuff being on there. And also bathing your dog more frequently. I know it's a big dog, but you may find that just a couple of times a week of using a medicated shampoo that would be appropriate for your dog would be helpful. Antihistamines, don't cut it for most dogs. I mean, it may help. They're very safe to use long term, but they really don't, you know, really do the job that well. So I still say go ahead and try them, but you may want to also consider, if you're looking at just things that you can add in, a fatty acid supplement, something like that, to help decrease some of that inflammatory change. Then we start looking at other drugs, and this is where we get into either using drugs in the steroid line, like prednisone. I don't like to use that, but sometimes it just puts the fire out if we just use it for a few days. You can also use steroids in topical form if your dog's got certain areas like ears or feet that are really itchy. You can spray that on, and that may help and help cut down on some of the systemic signs of using like an oral steroid pill. And then another drug that we use is cyclosporine, which goes by the brand name of Atopica, happens to be one. And you may want to talk to your veterinarian about using that. That seems to be very helpful, and it does have some side effects, but it's much better than prednisone. So there's a few things to be dealing with, and you just realize this is going to probably be a lifetime problem for your dog, and you may want to consider investing in some allergy testing so that your dog can then go through the proper allergy treatment, which now you can give sublingual drops for allergy control, too. You don't have to give the shots anymore, which is really nice.
Really nice. Good luck, Cooper, and thanks a lot for calling. John in Burlington, Vermont. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much, Larry and Dr. Sandy. I had a quick question for you today. My husband and I live in Vermont, but we're from Wisconsin, and we recently had a delightful rescue puppy join our family. So we're looking ahead and planning holiday travel to go visit them back home, and we obviously want to take Rosie along to introduce them to her. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering what kind of recommendations you have. She's small enough where I've seen other travelers have a duffel bag type of thing, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. For dogs, because I don't know if I'm really comfortable with, I've heard that airlines put dogs underneath with the cargo, and that might be I'm just kind of mortified by that. So
yeah, well,
should we drive?
Yeah, it all depends on the size of your dog and the airline you're traveling with. There are some airlines that allow pets and others that don't, and you do have to pay an extra fee to have your dog be your carry-on. Obviously, they have to fit comfortably under the seat, and they have to be adjusted to being able to be in one of these carriers that will go underneath the airline-approved carriers under the seat. So you would start with, bringing a carrier home and having it opened up and throwing treats in, maybe feeding your dog in it, so that it becomes a comfortable spot for her to go. And then start taking her for some short car rides, and maybe even go to like one of the big box stores and carry her in like to one of the home improvement stores. It kind of sounds like an airport in there. And, just so that she gets that kind of jostling feeling a little bit and see how she does. And many dogs adjust quite well, and they just settle down and they're quiet on the airplane. Some airlines require health certificates, and so you may have to have a visit with your veterinarian to have proper documentation that your pet is healthy and doesn't have any contagious diseases. I wish they would do that for people. If you hear my voice, I had just been down in Georgia a couple weeks ago, and the person sitting next to me is hacking on the plane, and I'm like, why don't they make people get health certificates before they travel? But no, just the pets. So flying, if that works for her, that'd be great. I never recommend pets going in the belly of the airplane. Depending on the time of the year you're traveling, there are temperature embargoes. If it's over 80 degrees on either end of the trip, they won't take them. So obviously that's not going to be an issue this time of the year. But you also have to sometimes produce a cold adaptation certificate when it's the cold winter months that your dog, it's okay if it sits on the runway for a while and it can tolerate cold. And that's kind of a hard thing to have to sign away, because it's my pet can tolerate temperatures below 40. Well, that it's 30 below, and that's below 40. So I guess your pet can survive out there. So I'm always a little iffy on putting pets in the baggage area. Driving, same thing. You probably want to have your pet confined to a carrier, even in the car, or seat belted in. We just had a pet in last week that the owner had the dog in the back seat and slammed on the brakes because there was a deer in front of them. He didn't hit the deer, but the dog flew forward and hit the dashboard and ended up rupturing one of its kidneys and having a huge hematoma. And is now on pain meds and lucky to be alive. So things like this happen, and so having some plans that way, which means again traveling in the car, lots of practice ahead of time before you start heading west.
Mm-hmm. And good luck, John.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, appreciate the call very much. That's good. A lot of people be traveling with pets, and so that's great general information for many of us. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. Thank you so much for listening in. And if you have a question, call us at 1-800-642-1234 or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We always love that. We get lots of great photos. If you got a great pet photo, post it. Today would be a great day to do that at The Larry Mueller Show. Dan in Racine has a question. Let's go to Dan. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry and Dr. Sandy. I have a 16-year-old, 16-year-old cat that's doing something I think is referred to as mowing.
Oh, fur mowing, yes. That's where they will lick themselves and just have the hair is just kind of plucked off. And when the reason why we can determine whether the cat is actually losing hair or grooming it off is if you pluck just a few of those little stubby hairs from these spots and look at them under the microscope, you can see the ends are all broken and chewed. A lot of cats do this. They're almost like closet groomers, and typically it'll start on their belly and then may spread to other areas as well. We used to think that a lot of these cats had a behavior problem where kind of like a person chewing their fingernails to the quick or doing something like that. But looking into these cases, we're now realizing the majority of them probably have some underlying skin issue that's causing them to lick. And even though the skin itself may look normal, it's really important to start looking for other underlying causes. And so when I get one of these kitties in, I kind of do the easy stuff first. I will take a sample of hair and skin using a toothbrush for a fungal culture to rule out ringworm. We've seen cats, believe it or not, that have ringworm that don't present like the textbook cases of bald, scaly patches here and there. We'll do some skin scrapings to look for some parasites. And probably one of the more common parasites that cats can get, especially if your cat has had any contact with any other cats, is one called Demodex. Very different than the dog Demodex, and it can be contagious and it is itchy. Checking a stool sample to look for these parasites as well would be one of the things that we do. And then we will often start looking at, do we have an allergic component going on here too? And so we may do a food trial. I don't know if your cat would be eligible for this, because if they're on any specialized diets for other health problems like kidney disease or something, you may not be able to do this. But putting your cat on a hydrolyzed protein diet or a very protein limited type of protein, so like a venison and green pea diet, or rabbit and quinoa or whatever, and believe it or not, these are available, and we have them on that for several weeks to see if that doesn't improve the itching. Sometimes we'll even resort to, if we don't find mites but they don't respond to the diet, we will go through a dipping procedure to treat them for something like this as well, like a Demodex mite. So you can see it's a little complicated. You rule out everything to try to get down to the bottom of it. So a visit to your veterinarian, and hopefully they can get some answers so your cat will start growing some hair back for the holidays.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Dan, for calling. And Jim and Shano, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yes, good morning. We have a Tonkinese cat who is 3.5 years old. And about once a day, she gets to the point where she wants to bite. In fact, while I'm waiting for you, I'm in the dining room. She's up on the table beside me. She tried to bite me. What's the best way to cure that?
She's like just attacking your hand, or what is she doing?
The hand through clothing.
Okay. Well,
she's had sharp teeth.
Yeah. So what I would be recommending is, making sure that you are actually, you spend a good 30 minutes plus a day playing with her so that she's tired. And what does that mean? Using toys on strings and wands, things away from your body so that she will, be able to, play but not be using your hands or anything like that. I'd also be recommending that you consider making sure you carry a toy or something with you so that if you see her ready to like jump up on the table, you've got a little glitter ball or something in your pocket that you can toss, so you're redirecting her away from your hands. Avoid punishment, because sometimes the cat that will just ramp these cats up and they become more defensive. I don't know why your cat is biting. There's lots of reasons. Probably for a young cat, the number one reason is what's called play aggression, where she's just looking at you as a big mouse that needs to be, pounced on. So looking at trying to find something else that she can pounce on. And then, if your involvement with the toys is getting, a little old at times, there are lots of things available that are interactive toys that don't require a human. There's one that I like that's called the Fling-em-a-String. I know it sounds weird, but it's a little, like, kind of a belt-driven device that has a string on it that you hang from the doorknob. If you just Google interactive cat toys, all these things will come up. There's another laser toy that's called the Bada Beam that just shoots out a random laser around where the cat can chase it. The Undercover Mouse is a great one, which is this big yellow mat that has a motorized toy thing underneath it that moves in random directions. And again, it's like you being under the covers and having your cat pounce on your feet because they're moving. But this is a safer device. So that would be the direction I would take before you start looking at using anything aversive.
Good luck. Thank you for calling. Brock and Toma, it's your turn. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hello. I have a four-month-old Welsh Corgi that has a really bad drooling problem, only on the right side. Took him into the vet, and she checked his nerve to make sure his eyes blink and eyes dilated. Mm-hmm. Everything was fine. She said she's never seen that before.
So it just his face isn't drooping or anything, so it's just he has spit just coming out one side of his mouth.
Yeah, all the way down his chin is just soaked.
Oh, my goodness. And nothing in his mouth on oral exam. He's a puppy, so I'd assume he's probably going through some teething and losing teeth. Yeah.
Yep.
So, you know, making sure that he doesn't have any abnormal teeth that could be triggering this, you know, I think that would be one thing to look at. There are procedures that you can do to, you know, like the lip tucks and things like that, but that gets a little extreme to help stop some of the drooling. I'd really be looking at, is there anything like an oral disease going on that could be triggering this? And you know, you may have to look at, sometimes we have to do a sedated or anesthetized oral exam. If your puppy is going to be going in to be spayed or neutered, that would be a perfect time to have a really good look at what's going on in there. And so if it's all the time, that's bizarre. I mean, it's
And it's been ever since we brought him home at 8 weeks. He's always done it.
Yeah. You know, and I don't know. It sounds like it could be a neurologic problem where it's just continuing triggering it. But I really don't know off the top of my head anything that could stop that. But
yeah, that's what she said too. She said she's
never heard of it.
Well, you stumped me. Sorry.
Thanks, Brock.
Thank you very much.
But I bet you keep that in the back of your head.
I'm going to talk to our dental staff. I mean, we've got a wonderful group of veterinary dentists at the vet school, and you know, they do all kinds of things that, rather than just teeth, the whole oral cavity is kind of their domain. And I'm going to bring this up with them and just say, hey, what do you think? And maybe bring this up next month again.
Yeah, sounds good. And sometime we're going to have the dentist on sometime too.
Oh,
which would be kind of fun to do.
Yeah, they're a lot of fun, and it's a huge area in the veterinary world that I think owners just don't appreciate how important it is to have good hygiene for their pets' mouths.
Ann in Shell Lake, thanks for calling. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have an almost 8-year-old miniature poodle who was diagnosed with asthma, and he has been on Temeril P for about 3 years. And your last call about the dog with the allergies got me more concerned. I've always been concerned about having him on the prednisone or the steroid. And I'm just wondering, is there anything new that any other way to treat it besides steroids?
Yeah, I mean, there are. We have different inhaler type things. And of course, you know, when we use an inhaler, you put it in your mouth and you squirt it in. But they have these adapters that go on that, again, all you're doing is then giving the steroid or bronchodilators and so on right there locally. That would be another thing to think about too, is some dogs with asthma respond very well to just things like bronchodilators, which are not steroids, and that may help too. But, you know, in the meantime, you know, with your veterinarian's blessing, you may want to consider trying to lower the dose and see if your dog is tolerating things fine. And, you know, get him on maybe an alternate day dose while you maybe consider adding in some of these other things like bronchodilators or potentially using an inhaler.
Well, I do have him on an alternate day dose, which I did myself. My vet wanted him on it every day, and I give it to him every other day. But they said that there was no kind of bronchodilator inhaler that...
No, it would be a It would probably be a tableted form of medication.
A theophylline or something like that?
Yeah. You may want to consider, that would be something to consider. So, yeah.
I actually did try that on him when he was first diagnosed, and that didn't seem to do any good. He also has tracheal compression.
Tracheal collapse, yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
And that.
So I don't know if that's a component of that.
Definitely. I mean, that could be adding like that goose honk type cough and so on. A lot of small breed dogs will have a very flaccid or a soft trachea instead of having those nice cartilaginous rings. If you touch your own neck, you can feel your windpipe and it's firm. These dogs tend to have very like weak cartilage rings, and so when they start coughing or breathing hard, get excited, the trachea will start to collapse down, and then that just keeps, it's a vicious cycle. So keeping the weight off of your dog if it's overweight, which is going to be hard if they have to be on steroids periodically, not using a collar, making sure you're using a harness, that type of thing would be my recommendation. There are some surgical procedures, but they're a little risky as well.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Ann, for calling. And just in 20 seconds or so, should someone whose dog found a deer skull and antlers give the animal those antlers to chew on?
They break teeth, okay? As our dentist at the vet school would say, anybody that, any toy that if you hit yourself with it and it hurts. Don't put it in the dog's mouth, okay? Dogs, even though their teeth look massive, they have a very thin layer of enamel, and they are quite fragile. And so hard teeth like that, hard toys like that, no, don't use it.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest, will be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network. If animals are an important part of your family, I bet you want to keep them healthy and happy, but with new information coming out all the time and lots of different opinions, I know it's hard to know what to do as a responsible pet owner. Hi, Larry Mueller here. So glad you could join us today on the Ideas Network. Glad to have Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine as our guest. She's with us for the next half hour to share some new information and some timely advice. And whether you're a lifelong dog owner or you can't imagine life without your kitty around, she has some answers for your questions. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And even better, go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question there. If you got a nice photo of your pet, we'd love to see that as well. Click like while you're there. We'll send you regular updates on upcoming shows. Back after the news. We're talking your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Thank you so much for listening in today. She always has great advice to share with us, and I hope you'll join in if you have a question about your pet's health. Actually, behavior topics, we're going to deal with those on the 29th of the month. Patricia McConnell will be joining us then, so we'll talk behavior then. But right now, it's your pet's health, so give us a call. Go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there as well. And, Sandy, I know you wanted to mention something about microchips because there's issues there.
There is. Well, one thing is the Home Again chip company just announced that they have located and reunited their millionth pet since the chips have come out. So that's a really neat statistic. In fact, one of my dogs is one of on that list, okay, because they ran away and it was the microchip that got the dog back to me. But I had such a sad case in last week. Lucky for the cat, though. This was an adult cat that was adopted at the Wisconsin Humane Society. And the family, it was obviously well-loved. It had been declawed, beautiful, friendly, just the sweetest cat. And the new family that has this cat said that, yeah, the cat was microchipped, but because the people didn't register the information. Remember, the microchip is useless unless it's linked to a database. And so there's a, you know, veterinarians, we can go on. There's on the American Animal Hospital Association's website, there's a thing called microchip lookup. And anybody can go to that site. It doesn't even mean a veterinarian doesn't have to go to it. Even, you know, you as an owner, if you've got a pet that's microchipped and you want to make sure that it is registered, then just plug the number in of your pet's microchip into that spot, that microchip lookup. It'll tell you the name of the company, their 800 number, their website, so you can contact them and say, hey, do you have the right information? Because obviously, I mean, this was a well-loved cat, but now has a new home because that microchip, they couldn't find the owners.
So, yeah, that's, well, good for the cat, but sad for the other family.
Yeah.
You folks have a Facebook page now at the vet school, do you not?
Yes, UW Veterinary Care, and it's a nice little site that has all kinds of photos and kind of news things that are going on at the school, and some links to our YouTube videos. We've had lots of videos being produced on the different things that are going on in the hospital. So if you want a kind of a behind-the-scenes look at what's going on, I show up a few times in the hallways and stuff. I haven't actually gone through the interview process, but many of the clinicians in the hospital have, and it's a lot of fun to see them online like that.
And we have we link to that on my Facebook page, so we got that taken care of. So that's very good. Steve in Sheboygan has a question for you. Let's go to him. Hi, Steve.
Hey, how's it going, folks?
Good.
The question I have is, I have boxers, and I'm keeping, I just had a litter, and I'm going to keep one of the females because we show them also. And I was reading, or I overheard somewhere, that they have a new test now for OFA-ing dogs. Could you just tell me a little bit about it?
Yeah. What that those initials stand for is Orthopedic Foundation for Animals. And that is still available. It is a way of checking hips. They x-ray dogs when they're 2 years of age or older, and they're usually either sedated x-rays, and they get sent to radiologists. And it's very subjective. They look at these radiographs, and they grade the hips as excellent, good, fair, poor, dysplastic, so on. And so the problem with that is that, one, you're just seeing a snapshot in the, you know, at, in time when the dog's about two. And we have seen many dogs, when they get older, develop hip dysplasia. And yet they've already been used for breeding and showing and so on. And you really are kind of, your hands are tied. Once you find out, as a two-year-old, I mean, you've probably put in a big investment in showing your dog and so on, getting it ready to get to that point where it's got all its points and so on, and you want to use it for breeding. And then now you find out, whoop, her hips are bad, can't use her. So there's another type of hip check that's done, and it goes by the name of Penn Hip, like Pennsylvania, P-E-N-N, Penn Hip. It's done when they're much younger. You can do it when they're 16 weeks of age or up. And it looks, it's very different. They do these x-rays that have to be done under anesthesia, and they actually put these blocks in and look at the level of laxity in the hips. So this is done before they start developing arthritis, and you get to see, you know, are, you know, do we have that potential for running into troubles? The reason why it's, you know, good is that, one, you're not making that investment of time and money in a dog that you can't show or breed. It could be then sold for pet quality or whatever. And there are some surgical interventions that can be done. There's a treatment called juvenile pelvic symphysis, JPS, that is, where they can surgically affect the way the pelvis grows by affecting where the two halves of the pelvis join together. And so there are surgeries that can be done that will make the dog healthier longer. Obviously, you'd still want to take them out of the breeding pool. But, you know, so it's a totally different type of test. Obviously, it's much more expensive because of the anesthesia, and it does require some specialized veterinary training. Not all vets are able to do pen hip x-rays. So I know at the veterinary school we do them, and I'm sure there's other people around that have been through the training class and are able to do them as well.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thanks, Steve, for calling. Anna in Madison, hi to you.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
I have got a year and a half old lab Springer mix, and he does this thing where he drinks just way too much water anytime we let him near water, to the point where he'll get really bloated and then puke it all back up.
Okay.
And at the same time that that started, he also started compulsively licking upholstery.
Okay.
So we've talked to our vet about it, and they can't really give us any answers.
Well, you know, the last part of the show, I actually talked about dogs that are doing this compulsive licking of things. A high percentage of them have some type of gastrointestinal problem.
Is
and
that
so,
what the licking, I mean the drinking?
It may be. And I think that that may have to be treated almost as a separate entity. Your dog may be gorging on water, just like a dog would go out and eat grass and so on to make themselves vomit. It's possible they're doing that, but I think that it's also indicated when you have a dog that's drinking tremendous amounts of water like this to be looking at, is there another way you can present the water so that they get what they need, but, you know, smaller amounts so they don't gorge on it. Is there some medical problem with your dogs? Do they have some type of juvenile kidney disease or an infection or something that's making them want to drink more because they're making more urine? So part of the workup would involve checking some blood work and also checking a urine sample. And the best urine sample to always check in a case like this is the first morning urine sample. So in a healthy dog, I would say take the water away at night when you go to bed so that they don't have water. Collect that first sample in the morning and take it into your veterinarian to make sure that the kidneys are working all right. But yeah, that licking may be totally unrelated, but be on the search for some type of gastrointestinal problem.
Mm. There you go. Thanks, Anna, for calling. And Mary in La Crosse. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about my kitty. I have two cats in my household. One is 18 and one is 6, and they're very close friends. The 18-year-old is approaching the end of his life, and I've been struggling with the question of that time comes, euthanizing him at home for the sake of the younger kitty or older kitty or at the vet's office?
It's such a good question. And I'm happy that you are looking into all your options ahead of time rather than being, you know, at the last minute trying to make some decisions. And I know it's hard to plan this kind of stuff, but it really is important. And part of having a home euthanasia done is, is your cat comfortable with being handled or are they fractious? Sometimes kitties just don't want to sit still to have a catheter put in. And so when I have an owner call me about this, I say to them, well, here's a couple of options. Either bring your cat into the clinic and have an IV catheter put in the clinic setting where we have trained technicians and so on that can hold your cat, then go home and let them get relaxed and chill. And then, I can come to your home and do the euthanasia. Or there are many veterinarians starting more and more that actually have like a business where this is one of the things that they specialize in is hospice care, and home euthanasias too. If you don't want to do that, then sometimes what we're looking at is if we can't get to a vein in the cat because they're either too debilitated to be able to find a vein, we have to think about where else can we give the injection. And this happened to me recently with a patient, and I ended up having to do an intra-abdominal injection. And in that case, it took a long time for the cat to actually pass away. So we were there for about a half hour listening to the heart and until I was able to say that he's passed. And so it may be a little bit longer and a little more traumatic for you. Whether the other cat is going to, need to be there or not, I think it's always a good idea, whether it's true or not, but at least letting the cat see the remains. And so if you have the euthanasia done at your veterinary clinic, take the remains home. And if the cat wants to come over and sniff, great. But sometimes they don't and they have no interest at all. And, don't worry about it. But, then if you have to, take the remains back to your vet, I know it's a lot of transporting back and forth, but, that it may make you feel better to know that you've given it your all and allowed the other cat to realize that their buddy's gone. It's such a tough situation. And I really, I don't have any other words of advice for you except, have lots of Kleenex ready wherever you are. Because, I get teared up just like the owners do.
Yep.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Mary. Cindy in Lodi, hello. Cindy, are you there?
I am here.
Great. Thanks. What's on your mind?
I have a 6.5-pound yellow Pomeranian, and I had taken her to the veterinarian a couple months ago, and she has all the signs of Lyme's disease, but the test was negative.
Mm-hmm.
And he put her on doxycycline. Is that what it's called?
Doxycycline.
Mm-hmm. Doxycycline.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And some pain medication, too, because she's in a lot of pain. After the medication, there were still pain pills, and she still seems like she has all these signs of apparently signs of Lyme's disease. If I don't give her a pain pill, she just lays around the house and she can't jump because she's scared of to hold her paws or her back legs up like they ache,
mm-hmm.
and she has a real hard time eating.
Yeah, I'm really worried that she doesn't have, I mean, I think that there may be something else going on here. The majority of dogs that get exposed to Lyme, okay, Lyme disease, the Borrelia, it's not Lyme's. That's just one of the things, my pet peeves, actually one of my students this morning wrote down Lyme's, and I'm like, no, it's Lyme, Connecticut. And so, sorry, no S there, but I'll get off my soapbox here. But most dogs that get Lyme disease don't show any symptoms at all. Okay, they get exposed and they never become symptomatic. When they do show symptoms, there's kind of two classes of things we see, either kidney disease, and it's usually very acute in onset. It's called Lyme nephritis, and many dogs die from that. And then you see the joint involvement, where they have a fever, swollen joints, and it responds very, very quickly to the doxycycline, usually within a couple of days. The problem is that she's tested negative for Lyme, and the tests are very good. So you start wondering, do we have something else going on? Does she have some type of an immune-mediated arthritis, or does she have something orthopedically wrong? Being a small-breed dog, we see some hip issues. There's a condition called leg perthes that can cause them to have a lot of pain, where they lose some of the blood supply to the head of their femur, and they get arthritis. They sometimes run into issues with luxating kneecaps that can cause arthritis. So is there something else orthopedically wrong with her to account for her inability to jump up and do things? So I think it's either back to your veterinarian again and say, things are not looking good, what else can we be looking into, and not have that Lyme disease blinder on and say, oh, this is what it is and this is what we're treating, but start thinking outside of that and look at other things. Or getting a second opinion from someone to have your dog evaluated. And it may mean taking some x-rays. It may mean joint taps to be able to look at the joint fluid, maybe doing some specialized lab tests for some of these immune problems, see if we can get to the bottom of it. Mm-hmm. I hope we can get your dog some comfort.
I hope so, too. Thank you, Cindy. Good luck.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Jill in New Berlin. Hi.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a kitty that's about 11 years old, and for the last 3 or 4 years, he's been having this problem with vomiting. I've taken him to multiple vets, and at first we went the hairball route, and then it really doesn't seem like hairballs to me.
What is he vomiting?
It's primarily, he vomits up his food, like often right after he eats it.
Okay.
So we went the Pepcid route, thinking it might be acid-related. But lately, it's been mostly clear liquid and a lot of it, almost like a pint of clear liquid with a little bit of extra in there. He's had x-rays. They said all of his labs came back normal. A couple months ago, all of his labs were normal. And the only thing they could see was that they said his stomach lining looked a little thickened. But do you have any ideas about what else it could be?
Well, you know, one of the things that, again, kind of one of my pet peeves is so many people blame hairballs on everything that causes cats to vomit. And that most cats tolerate hair just fine. And sometimes when they are vomiting for other reasons, the hair just goes along for the ride. Probably the biggest mistake people make is assuming that a cat with asthma, which is where they actually will wheeze and kind of put their head out, looks like they might vomit, is actually a cat that is coughing or having some respiratory distress. So I'm glad that your veterinarian is kind of looking beyond that and saying what else could be causing this. So it sounds like you've done x-rays, you've done lab work. The next step would be probably scoping your dog and going in with an endoscope, or your cat, I apologize, it's having an endoscope placed down through your cat's mouth into through the esophagus, into the stomach, to actually look at the surface and maybe consider getting some biopsy samples done. I'm not sure if that's something your veterinarian's able to do. If not, referring your kitty to an internal medicine specialist would be something to be able to get to the next level. We usually on x-rays, it's hard to tell what's going on. So I think you're looking at jumping to that as the next step.
There you go.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you for calling. And Anne in Port Washington, what's on your mind? Hi.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm calling with a question about my neighbor's blind cat, who's actually a sister to my blind cat. I've been trying to help them, give them some advice. Their cat has recently started urinating just in front of the litter box. Mm-hmm. And it did seemingly start happening after they had a new baby. So it may be kind of behavioral. The baby and the cat seem to get along just fine, but he's just in front of that box.
Yeah, and so a few things. Always rule out medical problems. So going in and having some lab work done, a urinalysis done, to make sure everything's healthy and happy. Then we start looking at it from the behavior standpoint. And, I can just rattle off kind of my top things that I think need to be addressed is ease of access to the litter box. Are the sides too high? Is it hard for the cat to navigate into the box? They get better footing outside the box, making sure that you have more than one box and that the box is big enough for the cat to be able to go in. Litter box needs to be at least 1.5 times the length of the cat from head to butt. And so you take that cat and measure it and say, I got to get a box bigger than that. Most commercial boxes are not big enough for cats. And so that's why I recommend to people to use things like plastic storage bins, the cement mixing trays that you can get at, some of the home improvement stores. Even the trays that go underneath washers, where they sell washer and dryers and so on, you can get these plastic trays that are obviously the same size as a washer, but very easy for the cat to get in. And you can put litter in it, and it's got an inch or so side to obviously keep water in when it's being used for what it was intended for. But many cats will be able to use that as well. Making sure that they're cleaning the spot real well, that they're not leaving odors there to attract the cat back. So using something like Urine Off or AIP Anti-Icky Poo, my two favorite products for getting rid of urine odors. And then making sure that they are keeping the box clean. Now that they've got a baby, sometimes the litter box, it gets second, backseat to diaper changes. So making sure that they are keeping it clean. And hopefully that'll get to the bottom of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. It's funny. Our cats, Tiger, we have three boxes for the two kitties, mm-hmm. and two of them are very large, and then there's the one, like the old standard one.
Yeah.
That's the only one Tiger will use,
yeah.
The little one.
And it may be the location. It could be the depth of the litter in it. Every cat is different. And so when we have a problem, we sometimes have to provide cats with a smorgasbord of litter boxes and find out what they like.
Oh, boy. Let's turn to Katie in Fond du Lac. Hi, Katie.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
I have two cats that have been diagnosed with miliary dermatitis, and I would like to know how best to handle it.
Well, the fact that you have two cats with this condition, and what this is it's a skin condition cats get where they get little tiny scabs, usually like a little collar around their neck or down the midline of their back. And that's the classic kind of range where we see these little tiny scabs, and they're itchy. The most common cause is flea allergies. And so flea control, definitely flea control for both cats. The fact that both have them makes me wonder, something that they're probably sharing. It would be unlikely to have two cats that have allergies at the same time or, have developed food allergies or anything.
But fleas.
Fleas, yes, And in fact, getting a flea comb, I think, is a good idea, and combing your cat to look for flea droppings. But, I think that would be the easiest thing. And over a third of cats respond to just flea control. So it'd be the easy thing to do.
And Dr. Sandy, thank you so much. Now, you're usually here on the second Tuesday of the month, but in December, you're here the first Tuesday.
I am. December 4th, I'll be here.
And we'll look forward to it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Next month, it's the first Tuesday of the month, so December 4th, she will be with us. And I want to thank you for listening, and I hope you'll stay tuned because there's lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us.